Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all here with us. And we're going to explore this, the announcement that 6,000 men, mostly men, are coming home from federal prisons and what that means. When you look at the numbers of people in federal prison in America, 205,000 people, I think, are incarcerated in our federal prison system. This is like 0.02% of those people being freed. There are 25,000 people almost in privately managed facilities, 16,000 men and women who are in different types of facilities. Numbers of those people are nonviolent offenders. And so we're going to talk about what this means. These folks have been released and where they're going. And in the studio with us is Dominique Stevenson, who's program director for the American Friends Service Committee, co-author with Eddie Conway of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. Sarah Love joins us. She's a public policy director for the ACLU of Maryland. And Tara Huffman is director of the OSI Baltimore's Criminal and Juvenile Justice Program. And Dominique, Sarah, and Tara, good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. But do join us, 410-319-8888. This is a huge step for a president to make. We haven't seen a president make this kind of step before, Dominique, in our history. But the question, I think, I'd like to hear from your perspective, being an activist for all these years around prison issues and the rights of people imprisoned. Where do you think this takes us? What does it mean?
Not very far. I mean, it is a drop in the bucket in terms of the federal system, and having had the experience of like working with some folks in a federal prison, I've seen people who are there serving multiple life sentences on drug charges. And so it's like, this is to me like a drop in the bucket in terms of the breadth of the actual problem there. You have people from cities around the country who've been swept up and charged under RICO statutes and given, one case, there's a guy, he's serving more time than a Unabomber. 11 life sentences. His so-called crime didn't involve a murder. It didn't involve a body in any way. And even in court, they acknowledged that the maximum sentence generally given for those drug charges were 20 years. So to the degree that damage has been done, it's a drop in the bucket. And I think that I hope that people don't get too excited and pull back. There's a need to really, really keep pushing. A lot of damage has been done by these, under these laws. And we need to really, really keep pushing. We can't stop here. I don't view this as a win. I don't even view it. It's like, I guess I come from the school of bite the hand that feeds you activism. They're only giving us, to some degree, and not even that, what's owed to people.
Sarah?
I'd say it's a baby step. I think our country is slowly becoming aware of our addiction to mass incarceration, and we're grappling with what do we do with it and how do we fix it. And this is a baby step, but one of the things, picking up on what Dominique just said, is people can't rest on this, because some folks are going to be coming home, and that's great, but we have destroyed their lives. And it's been done in primarily a racial manner, destroying communities of color. So the folks coming out can't get jobs, are going to have a hard time getting housing. So this is just the first step in what has to be a very long process. It's a very complex, complicated process, and we can't just say, oh, now they're out, everything's over, because there's still more people that are in that shouldn't be in, and the folks that are coming out are going to need a lot of support because we have destroyed their lives. And one more thing,
go ahead, please.
I wanted to put out there is that, 2,000 of the people that are coming out are immigrants, many of them lawful permanent residents. And instead of being released, they will be taken straight into immigration detention and placed in immigration proceedings, and most certainly without a bond hearing for the entire duration of their proceedings, no matter how long they last. So they're just trading one prison for the next.
I was going to raise that point, but that's something that people don't realize in this release of 6,000 people, that those 2,000 more people who are being put back in another prison many of whom could be sent out of the country, deported from this country.
Yes.
And I think that also was part that this was the, to me was one of the unspoken parts of this release was ways of getting rid of the thousands of men and women who are incarcerated in federal prisons who have been undocumented people and documented people in this country. I think that that's part of this release that we're really not paying attention to at all.
Exactly. And the only difference really is where you were born. One group will be given a second chance, hopefully with support, but, you know, that remains to be seen. And the other group is told one strike, you're out, and you get double punishment for your crime. You know, even if they've paid their debt to society, even if they reformed significantly during their time in prison, even if they're lawful permanent residents.
So, you know, I really wanted to be very happy as soon as I heard this about 6,000 people being released from prison. I did when I first heard it. You know, I was going, "Oh yes, mm-hmm. people are getting are going to be freed after spending 15, 20 years in prison for being found with cocaine or coke in the back seat of their car and no other violent record and no criminal record, but sent away." But I think that you think we can hear maybe sort of begin a discussion here and other places around Dominique to kind of really get to the heart of what's going on here. I mean, because I think both in terms of the history of why this is taking place and also the effect it's having on the communities that we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, like anybody getting out of prison is a good thing as far as I'm concerned at this point, especially after, you know, years of working with folks inside and not seeing very many people actually come outside. But I think that, one, this country has overstepped itself in terms of its capacity to keep these folks inside. I mean, when you look at crime and you look at incarceration rates, you will see periods where crime has actually gone down or it's leveled off. It definitely hadn't gone up, but the incarceration rate continued to rise. And so they don't have the capacity. If you continue to bring people in on the front end, you at some point have to decrease some of the numbers on the back end. So you begin to let people go. Also, I mean, even when you look at here in Maryland, the Unger case, you got people who were freed under because they basically, you know, the juries were given faulty instructions. Well, you get people who've been locked up for 40 years. Of course, they're going to sign away their rights. They're not going to contest it. They're not going to challenge the state about the fact that you've held me wrongfully, you know, for years. And so I think that the desperation for people to get out, they'll waive any rights, any attempt to go back and get any form of reparation for what has happened to them. Like the case I spoke about where these folks, one, received 11 life sentences, and it was way in excess of the maximum penalty for the crime. So I think it also prevents that kind of challenge, you know, to the government, that kind of legal challenge. But the reality is, to me, this actually just opens up the discussion yet again for the need for reparations. You've had communities that have been, you know, affected by this, have been harmed, you know, by this maddening need to incarcerate folks.
We have to take a very quick break for ID and for the news. We'll read this tweet that came in from Xavier, which is really interesting about the release. And we'll read that when we come back. We'll be back with Sarah Love and Dominique put together, Dominique Stevenson, in just a minute. So stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. It's Mark Steiner as we continue our conversation about the release of 6,000 federal prisoners. On the way of the conversation, I want to remind you all, a taping of Telesur, which is the Venezuelan TV network program, The Empire Empire Flies with Abby Martin, Tuesday night at 9 p.m. at the Real News Network. They will screen the first Democratic Party debate, and afterward, Abby Martin will moderate a panel with Sarah Yaffe, Bhaskar Sunkara, Jared Ball, Kamal Franklin, and Delegate Joe Carter. So for more information, you can go to therealnews.com and be part of the audience and stay late and have fun. So we are here with Dominique Stevenson, Program Director for the American Friends Service Committee and co-author with Eddie Conway of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther, and Sarah Love, who's Public Policy Director for the ACLU of Maryland. And you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. And Xavier tweeted in, it will save us taxpayers an estimated $125 million a year. We save money, and nonviolent offenders get their lives back. Your thoughts, Sarah?
Yes, I agree. But as I said earlier, we can't stop there because, you know, these folks are going to be coming back, and they're going to need robust reentry programs. They're going to need changes to employment laws so that, you know, those who were swept up in these misguided, racially biased drug war craziness can reintegrate back into society.
Dominique?
Yeah, I'm still questioning to what degree it's going to save us taxes, because I'm of the firm belief that they're going to fill those beds that they are currently emptying. And so maybe in the initial stages, it will appear that we're going to save, but I think that they will replace those empty, those folks. You know, they will simply put more people back into the system. I don't see anything that has demonstrated that that trend has really, really slowed or stopped.
So, you know, I've been reading a lot about this. And, of course, a lot of the very conservative media, the Fox Television, other places, have been saying this is letting career criminals back on the street. It's going to cause more violence. And more crime is going to take place because of it. I mean, that commentary exists in a major way in parts of our media. But I haven't seen much conversation about the other part of what this might mean and what it really means to kind of reform the system and the kind of the getting under the issue. And so I'm curious about where you think we need to take this conversation. Where does it have to go now? I mean, what do we have to do to push this?
I guess, you know, when we talk about criminality in this country, a lot of times that dialogue is disconnected from the economic situation and the fact that people are coming a lot of times from communities where they've seen the loss of industry. The jobs that existed 40 or 50 years ago don't exist. And so we really need to talk about those issues as well. And the fact, I think that Sarah brought these things up about the difficulty that people will have finding jobs based on the fact that they've been incarcerated. There's so many pieces to this that I think we need to address, but the economic situation in many of these cities, and that may be an assumption on my part, but having worked in one of the federal prisons with folks, I know a lot of them are coming from major cities in the U.S., but these are cities like Cleveland, like Baltimore, that have seen the loss of industry, and that industry hasn't been replaced with jobs or employment opportunities that allow people to live and thrive.
Sarah?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, because you can't just address the incarceration issue without addressing, Mark, as you said, the underlying issue. And it's economics, it's housing, it's education, it's all of these things. I mean, all of these racially biased policies that, you know, we call it white flight, but it's much more than that. It's housing policies that made favorable conditions for whites to move out, made it difficult for blacks to move, changed the transportation, changed the economics of it, and that created these poor communities. So you've got to address what those policies have done and sort of untangle that mess and create job opportunities there. And then you've got these returning citizens who have records, so it's going to be hard for them to get jobs. It's going to be hard for them to get housing. It's going to be hard for them to get education. We've created a big mess for our society, and it's going to take a lot to dig out of it. And the conservative, you know, oh, it's going to cause more crime and it's going to cause more problems, is a really easy thing to say, and it's, in my opinion, it's a cop-out. It's not addressing the problems that we've created and the problems that we now have to solve.
Well, let me just pause something to the two of you. I think that there is going to be kind of a new debate happening in America here about the roots of this and where we go. Michael Javen, I think is his middle name, Fortner, has written this new book on the Black Silent Majority, which I just received and started reading but seen a lot of critique of it. I don't know if anybody on the panel has seen it yet. But one of the things he posits in this book, and there's some reality to it, was that part of the root to the drug war was the people that one would consider progressives and radicals on some levels in the black community calling for longer sentences and being arrested and being put in jail because of the plague of crime people talked about in black communities. And then Ronald Reagan, attaching himself onto that, starting to sign and make drug laws that the vast majority of the black caucus in Congress supported. I'm raising this issue because I think we're about to enter into, as I've talked to my producers about, a debate on where we came from and where we're going. And this is going to be part of that debate. So I'm wondering your thoughts on all that, especially in terms in light of where these 6,000 have been released, but how much more has to, about how that barely touches the surface, and given the debates we're about to see. Sarah?
You know, I think that's very interesting. That's the first I have heard of that. And I'd love to take a look at that book and really sort of think through all of that. And what it brings to mind for me is people, when we point out the mass criminality of communities of color, people always say, well, they're calling, you know, there's so much crime there and they're calling for the police in their neighborhoods. And you have to disentangle those two things. The over-policing, and so, you know, rounding up people who are just standing on the street corner and grilling them and, you know, searching them for drugs, versus there's a crime and they want the police to come in and help them with it. So there are a whole lot of issues tangled up in there. It's an interesting thing. I'll take a look at that book.
Yeah, I'll send that out to all of you. I mean, I've been, and I read the critique of that book, which I think was some people have said was too linear, didn't look at the complexity of it. But that's just it. It's the complexity of it, I think.
Yeah, and I agree with Sarah. I think, one, when you look at what was really happening, like in the 80s, the spread of crack cocaine, the things that were occurring in the community, and those things are still not disconnected from the fact that there was a major loss in industry and jobs, that people were calling for relief. They weren't saying, please come in and militarize your force and occupy our communities in ways that are going to be detrimental to us. They weren't calling for more need to fear the police. You know, I think people still have this idealistic expectation that the police are going to protect and serve. The reality is, for black folks, that hasn't really been our experience in many cases. And so I don't think that folks, I think folks were looking for relief, and I think that they're entitled to that relief. People are entitled to live in communities that are safe, that feel safe and feel comfortable. The reality is that's only going to come about, though, by those same communities looking at these situations and deciding how they want to deal with the drug dealers, how they want to deal with the drug trade in their community, and also incorporating restorative practices. I don't think that folks necessarily wanted that 15-year-old to be locked up in an adult prison for selling drugs, you know, for 20 years.
410-319-8888. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the 6,000 people released. There are many of our listeners whose families are incarcerated, members of their families are incarcerated. Some of you may be the relatives, parents, sons, brothers, sister of people coming back to Maryland from the federal prison system. And we know many of you have called in with what you've been up against with our criminal justice system. So do join us at 410-319-8888 when you hear your thoughts on what this 6,000 means and what it means here. I mean, I think one of the things I've heard is that people are not really in the 6,000 coming home necessarily, but going to other facilities. Which is a big difference than coming home. Going to a half, go ahead. What were we going to say, Sarah?
Yes. No, I was going to agree that some of them are going to a halfway house. And like we said, you know, 2,000 immigrants won't be released. They're going to be straight into immigration detention and placed into immigration proceedings. So it's not what some of the fearmongers might have you believe. It's not that we're all of a sudden going to be having, you know, 6,000 people coming straight out of federal prison on the streets. They're going to halfway houses, they're going to programs, and unfortunately, many of them are going to be reincarcerated.
What do you mean by that?
I meant the immigrants and lawful residents who are going into the immigration proceedings.
Yeah,
they're going to be held in detention.
And the question is also where people are coming home to, right? I mean, that's a huge issue, what people are coming home to, which you're saying is the same issues that we've always faced, Dominique, of in terms of employment and where we are. Mm-hmm. Sitting here now, Eddie Conway, I remember the first thing that Eddie said, what you said when you came out of prison, I'm sorry, he's not in this part of the program, we'll be the next one, but Eddie said coming out of the prison was that driving from prison to where he was going that day when he got out, the first thing that he noticed was that the communities he left looked like he was going through Dresden. He was going through bombed out parts of Germany after World War II. That's the feeling that he had. And many men will come back to places that are unrecognizable, Dominique, in terms of what's happened to those communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've worked with young men who've been gone away for 5 years and come out and go back to Park Heights and say, wow. You know, so that's how fast, how rapid things are changing as well. But I think the one thing that we can't ignore about this, too, is that from my experience in working inside with folks doing programming is that people do change. So many of those folks are also going to come out very changed people. And we have to acknowledge that. And I think that there's too little acknowledgement of that aspect and that these are people that in many cases are also needed in these communities, too.
Now, that's a critical point that we never talk about, is how much the community needs the men back and what that means and what they mean to a community when they can come in and take hold and change things. Let me come back to that thought, but let's go to the phones here. What are you thinking? 410-319-8888. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Jackie.
And good morning to the rest of your guests. I'm curious as to whether or not this massive release of incarcerants has anything to do with that population of prisoners aging out and no longer serving the purpose of being a part of the industrial system in jails, as well as that group that's being released becoming ill and sick and now a burden on that system. I'm going to get off and hear what you guys have to say.
Yeah, I have not followed that closely. Sarah, have you?
You know, I haven't. I haven't heard a breakdown of that, but it's a really interesting question, and it raises another problem with our incarceration nation, is that we have an aging population of people who are in prison and that are becoming, you know, as you get older, you have more ailments, and that's more expensive on our system. So it's creating a whole new set of problems.
Yeah. Dominique?
I haven't heard that either, and I think it's kind of across the board. Some of the folks that I certainly know who, when all the buzz started about the Justice Department and about the potential for people to get released, you know, these were folks of all different ages, and so I'm assuming it's going to be across the board. I don't know.
Has anybody done kind of a study, a look at just who should be released from prison? How many tens or hundreds of thousands of people we're talking about, maybe more than that, in our state and federal prisons that should actually be released now? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, has anybody really got into that deeply?
I don't know about that, but I know that in New York you have an effort called, I think it's something like RAP, Release Aging Prisoners, and I'm pretty sure that these folks are gathering data and looking at cost and looking at that in New York State.
Sarah, do you know anything about that?
You know, I don't know about that specifically. I know here in Maryland, by statute, we created the Justice Reinvestment Coordinating Council, and so there are legislators.
What?
There are legislators and some others who are looking at the incarcerated population and figuring out, you know, how to reduce the incarcerated population safely, how to reinvest that money into safer communities and, you know, drug rehab and all of that. I don't know if they're focusing on exactly, you know, the older population, but what ways we can reduce our incarcerated population overall.
See, I think one of the things, I mean, when we look at trying to argue about and discuss setting up a system that is restorative and transformative, that is not about just incarcerating human beings for long periods of time or any period of time. The other ways of addressing this, that's why I raised the issue. I mean, I don't think we even know who the people are who we have incarcerated.
I think you're exactly right. We don't. And one of the things that's even worse about that, Mark, is we don't even know not only who's incarcerated, but how they're being held. One of the problems that we've been having here in Maryland is trying to find out who's being held in segregated confinement, which is a nice little euphemism for solitary, meaning they're held in a cell by themselves or with one other person for 22 to 24 hours a day. You know, we don't even know who's in there. So the prisons are just a black hole, if you will.
So, I mean, that's interesting to me. I think that in all this conversation, and I haven't thought about this in a long time this way, but it's somehow, Dominique, it seems to me the conversation we need to have, push in the state legislature, push in the public, is unearthing that black hole and making it transparent to know who and what, who's in there, why they're there, what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, what you've seen increasingly probably in the last 20 to 30 years is pushing people, pushing outside folks out, further out, the decrease in programming. I mean, programming is coming down to mostly religious programming, a little bit of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous,
right,
but very little other programming. And we have this entity in the state called public safety, and I can't think of anything that is less public than that department. The public needs to be engaged. If you're ensuring my safety, I want to know how you're doing it, what's going on. You know, there's not that kind of access anymore. And you look at how prisoners are limited in terms of their ability to just pick up the phone. They can't pick up the phone and call the media if something's going on. The
right.
media is not on their list of 5 or 10 names that they can actually call. So all of these things are happening that are further, you know, just keeping people isolated and keeping people away from, you know, family members, not just the public, but actually just keeping them in isolation even from their families.
Right. And I will say, giving credit where I think credit is due, it may not be moving as fast as we would like it to, but the whole premise behind and the work of the Justice Reinvestment Coordinating Council here in Maryland and the work of many advocates on solitary reform, and Secretary Moyer, who has said, yes, we need to work on solitary confinement and understand who's in there and make some reforms there. So I think we're taking steps in the right direction. We still have a long way to go, though, but we are at least beginning to understand that we have to take these steps.
And I think that, I mean, one of the demands coming up, it seems to me, in our world this next year, in these years we're facing, should be just that, about who gets released and releasing more people. I mean, I think that's – because you're right. I mean, Dominique, all the programs that existed at one point in prison, allowing people to go to college, allowing people to take mm-hmm. courses, allowing people to get the skills to go outside and get a job are gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have been taken away. And Pell Grants taken away, except for a small experiment that they're doing for a few people out of the federal government because they can't get through the state – morass of state government. So I think that, I mean, these are the kind of questions I think we need to be pushing and asking if we're serious about the kind of change we're talking about. We can't even get through the legislature. The governor has signed the bill allowing men and women who come out of prison on parole to vote.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was so frustrating. Oh, my gosh. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that decision.
Yeah, I mean we'll look at that as we walk our way up to our Annapolis summit in January. 410-319-8888. Let's get a call in here before we have to break for the segment. Kenneth, you're on the air. Welcome.
All right, how you doing, everyone?
Very well. Welcome.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's pull out the old blackboard. You know, this is big business. Incarceration is big business. Let's look at what we got here. Medical department. That's big business. Okay. These are all the things that they look forward in incarceration that they need. Food service, okay? Then we got the commissary, got to eat, maintenance, got to fix those belt bars up. You got, and to go on and on, you know, but what are we getting out of it? Nothing. No education, no rehab. After leaving, you go back through that revolving door and you do the same thing. Inmate has nowhere to go, no job. everything is held against him even after he has served his time. So it's big business, ladies and gentlemen. Big business.
Big business, Dominique. I mean, I think that's the other part of this. People do talk about that. The money being made on our prison system is, and what it does to employ people. I mean, in the state alone, in the Eastern Shore, where employment has gone up in working class white communities, and in Western Maryland, mm-hmm. that's where we're putting our prisons.
Yeah. The federal prison that I do programming at, I'm not going to mention it because I want to keep going in there to do that programming, but it sits in a rural part of Virginia. And in that area, mostly prisons, federal and state. As a matter of fact, Wallens Ridge is also there. And I believe that Wallens Ridge was built by the Housing Authority in that particular county to create jobs. And it sits on the top of a mountain that they had, the mountaintop removal that was going on in West Virginia around the coal industry. But also what's in that area, it's very close to Appalachia. You see the old coal mines that are no longer, in use. And so, yeah, these prisons have created jobs for rural communities who, in some cases, have welcomed these prisons into the community. There was a time when nobody wanted these prisons or these facilities in their backyard. Now you have people competing to get them in their backyard.
Sarah?
Another thing that this raises is the industry of private prisons. And we're fortunate in Maryland that we don't have those, but those are very much moneymakers, and that takes us back to one of the early comments that Dominique made in terms of, if you build it, they will come, and refilling those beds. I have some hope that, when they're not private prisons, we hopefully won't fill those beds, but private prisons are definitely for profit.
I mean, the state of Maryland makes a lot of profit on those prisons, which is why I argue that they don't have private prisons. Why would they cut out their profit? I think Maryland is number 17 in terms of states that profit off the prison industry.
We are about to go to break here, but we have been exploring what the release of 6,000 prisoners mean and doesn't mean in terms of the entire question of how we reform this criminal justice system and the reality of that. You heard Dominique Stevenson, Program Director for the American Friends Service Committee, who co-authored with Eddie Conway, Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther, and Sarah Love, who is Public Policy Director for the ACLU of Maryland. I want to thank you both for being here for this segment. Dominique will be staying with us for the next segment, joining Eddie Conway as we look at what's happening in Gilmore Homes. Stay with us, and Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.
We will be right back, so don't go away.